Welcome this afternoon to Dhammaloka Buddha Center. I think most of you look very familiar, so I think hardly need to introduce myself, but for those who don't know, my name is Ajahn Nisarano. I'm one of the monks from Bodhinyana. Though I'm on the, this sounds good, the unattached list. and spending most of my time in Sri Lanka at the moment, so. This afternoon, for those who don't know, I was going to read and comment, and like to hear your comments too. We'd discuss the sutta number 19 from the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's called the Dvaidaha Vitaka Sutta, which is the two kinds of thought. So we'll do that in a moment.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
Good. I'd like to congratulate you too for coming out on a very warm afternoon. First of summer, I think. So good. So I'll read the sutta, and as we go along, I'll make comments and hopefully remember to pause to ask for your comments or questions, anything you would like to contribute to the sutta reading and discussion. So, the sutta begins. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Sarvati, in Jetta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty." I'll just make a comment there where the Buddha is talking about when he was a bodhisattva. The commentaries say that this was, when he's talking about this period, this is a period when he was practicing his austerities, these very severe ascetic practices, you know, for instance, eating hardly any food and practicing out in the open when it was hot, and many other sort of practices that reduced him almost to a human skeleton. But it was during this period of these 6 years of this striving that this thought, these thoughts occurred to him. It's quite likely, I think, that this is not long before his enlightenment. And I was wondering if people recognized when we talk about thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty, if anybody recognized what this is pointing to. This is a the defilements. Lynn's just suggested the defilements. Anybody else got any other thoughts? Liberation, for sure. For sure. But do you know any other teaching that this is the same as another teaching? It's fundamental to the Buddha's teaching, actually. Do you recognize it? Actually, this is one of the teachings Ajahn Brahm gives a lot here, actually. But he calls it letting be or letting go, kindness, and he calls it gentleness. But this is the same, actually, same. This is, my goodness. I thought people would get in a flash, actually. Sorry? That's right. The positive side of non-ill will and non-cruelty, definitely metta, and definitely compassion, karuna. That's right. This is actually the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, samasankappa. This is what the Bodhisattva is investigating and developing. So it sort of points to, you know, that the Bodhisattva was developing the Noble Eightfold Path during his 6 years of searching. And this actually does, you know, seem quite logical, because it would be rather strange if all the knowledge that he developed, he came upon, occurred just in the night of his enlightenment. It was obviously a progression towards his enlightenment. And this was an important aspect of it, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And, of course, when you read the sutta, you realize this is another telling of how the Buddha became enlightened. And you can't quite tell when he was contemplating these thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty. But quite likely, as I say, shortly before he became enlightened. So it's quite interesting. And you might say, well, why is this very important? Why is the second noble factor, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path so important? To me, it's very much the how to do in the Noble Eightfold Path, how we should approach practice, practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, but also practicing meditation. And what it's talking about, of course, with renunciation, another word for that, is letting go. And this is the essence of the path, isn't it? You know, the path is not about getting more, gaining, building up, achieving. The path is letting go and not gaining, as it were, getting rid of, actually, in a way. Especially the defilements. So when we have that attitude, we're going in the right direction for the path. If we are not trying to gain and get, this is not the aim of the path. And also the Buddha's pointing out the fact that when we practice a Noble Eightfold Path, we have to practice it with non-ill will. At the minimum level, that means that we don't have this aversion or anger towards ourselves or to other people. And so it's pointing at the fact that if we practice meditation of the Noble Eightfold Path with a strong sort of aversive mind state, we are not practicing in the right way. And the same with cruelty, non-cruelty. If we're practicing, you know, sometimes people like to practice hard, you know, no pain, no gain, no pain, no pain, no gain. That's it, no pain, no gain. So they have this attitude, and it's actually often, if you look at it, if you investigate it, where's it coming from? It's actually coming from a lot of aversion, actually, quite a bit of negativity, and it's often being cruel to oneself, actually, more than other people. So this is why this sutta is so, you know, quite an important one for us, because it gives us an understanding of sammasankappa, which is often called right thought, though I prefer right attitude. Because these are attitudes that we bring to life, we bring to the Noble Eightfold Path, we bring to meditation. And the Buddha is saying these are attitudes that are helpful, these attitudes are positive, useful, and he talks about it in more detail as we go along. So, good. Anybody like to make any comments? Now that you disagree, this is not sammasankappa. Right, so we can continue. And the Buddha, actually, talking about his experience, said, "As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulty, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it." So this is quite an interesting passage. This is the sort of, when you read into it, when you look at it closely, this is how the Buddha was abandoning sensual desire. And everybody, I think, should know this. Why is the Buddha so keen on abandoning sensual desire? Why the emphasis? Why is this number one? What's so important about sensual desire? True, it doesn't lead to peace, to stillness, any other. Exactly, form of greed, yes. And it's actually craving, isn't it? You know, it's the second noble truth. This is what is generating most of our suffering, is this craving for sensual desire. There are other cravings, of course, the Buddha talked about them, and it doesn't lead to peace. The interesting thing too, of course, with sensual desire, where does it lead us? Outside of ourselves. The focus is always out there, getting, you know, this really nice sight. We might want to travel, we might want to watch videos, see movies, that sort of thing. Or have nice conversations, listen to beautiful music, eat delightful food, have nice perfume smells, and massages, touches for the body, all these things. But these are the things that we live for in a very big way. Because you see, I remember Ayakema would always talk about, you know, how we have a house. When you look at our homes, when you look at the house, it's built for the body, isn't it? But where's the home for the mind in the house? Because you have a house, you know, and you have a bedroom, that's where you sleep, and you have toilets, and you have kitchens, dining room, all these things, lounge room and so on. But it's built for the body. And this is where, you know, the emphasis in our lives very naturally goes towards sensual desire and sensory experience. And often when you call it sensual desire, it sounds like something incredibly intense, you know, like some sensualist, you know, talking about sensualists, you know, somebody who is really indulging. But we all indulge, really, to quite a large degree. And this is why the Buddha is putting the emphasis on sensual desire, seeing sensual desires. Yes. Consider that. That's a very good point. Rodney's just saying that when the Buddha says he considered us as a bodhisattva and he abandoned it, there must be a lot more than just, you know, thought processes going on. And of course, I think when you look at this, actually investigate, you see that there is quite a bit of other things going on, because one of the things that I noticed with it is that the Buddha said he understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. That to me, first of all, points to the fact of mindfulness. If we are aware of something, then, I don't know about you, but often when I'm aware of a mind state, even thoughts, when there's that sati, that mindfulness, that state can often disappear, can often be abandoned just by knowing. And this is the first level I think the Buddha's pointing to, actually, is that just by knowing that he understood, this is a thought of sensual desire that has arisen in me. Just knowing that was enough to abandon. And it is true for us too. And this, of course, is usually at a level, not a very deep level, because if you have a very strong sensual desire, just knowing it probably won't be enough. But if it's a much weaker form of sensual desire, yes, it can be abandoned reasonably easily just by knowing it, rather than, I like this, quotation, I'm not quite sure who quoted it, who made the original quotation, by seeing something rather than being it. Because often these defilements, like sensual desire, these strong desires in our minds, they take us over and we're caught up in it so much, we don't recognize it for what it is. So the very first step is to know this is sensual desire. Because sensual desire, like all the defilements, they con us, don't they? They make us think, well, this is a good thing, you know, well, I have to have this, don't I? I won't be happy without it. And, you know, the justifications comes in too, you know, that props up this. So So this is the first level, I think, this mindfulness that the Buddha was bringing to it. And of course, even as a Bodhisattva, I think that mindfulness would have been very piercing, you know, enough to dispel many, you know, quite strong sensual desire. So that was the first thing he said. And the other thing, it is a bit of a process, because the second factors that come in, this leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. This is very much like, there's another sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts, the next sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha recommended this as a second method for dealing with distracting thoughts when we're meditating, getting quite peaceful. He said to look at the danger in things, look at the disadvantages in things, in these thoughts that one's having. And if you see the affliction that is bound up with it for oneself and for others, then if you really see it, you have to see it at quite a deep level. It's like a smoker, isn't it? If a smoker, they might think, well, yes, it's a good idea to give up smoking, isn't it? Yes, definitely a good idea. But will they do it? Not until they really see, well, look, this is harming me. It's no good for my family, my friends. It's harming both of us. Only when they see at a very deep level can somebody really give up a negative state of mind. So this is quite an important thing when one sees the affliction. I don't like this word affliction so much, because I think I don't relate to it so much. I think harm is quite a good word for that, when one sees the harm in something. So, and it obstructs wisdom. Anybody got any ideas why it obstructs wisdom? What is obstructing wisdom? Sensual desire is, but can you see it as, does anybody have an idea of what the Buddha's pointing to there? Another category, actually.
Seeing how things really are.
That's what we aim to do, yes. But before that, got to remove the obstructions. And the obstructions, of course, the hindrances. And sensual desire is one of the first kamachanda, the first hindrance. So this is why it obstructs. You might remember from the Buddha's suttas, from the Buddha's teachings, that he often describes the hindrances as weakening wisdom. And here, I think when he says obstructing wisdom, he's talking about the same thing, these hindrances. As Ajahn Brahm often says, I've heard him say, the hindrances are the only thing standing between us and enlightenment. So they're quite formidable, and they're not an easy thing to overcome, especially permanently. So they obstruct wisdom, cause difficulties. And this, you see this essentially, you know, with sensual desire, don't you? Whenever we have a craving, we want something, there's always problems that come along with it. It's amazing, too often, I've seen this with myself, you get what you want, but it's not quite as you imagined, you know, so there's suffering there, and then you have to think, oh, what am I going to do, how am I going to look after this, and all these things. So it's quite interesting, it's always bound up, causes difficulties. And it reminds me of the saying that if we have a lot of attachments, we have a lot of suffering. If we have few attachments, we have few sufferings. If we have no attachments, we have no suffering. But these attachments is in the form of sensual desire, getting what we want, quite natural and very compelling. Because they're always offering us the illusion that this will make us truly happy. You know, this will be just what we need. So then he says, and it leads away from Nibbana, and I think this is exactly what Rodney was pointing to, that it doesn't lead to peace. Because Nibbana usually is one of the synonyms for Nibbana is the peaceful state. So, but it also leads away from Nibbana in the sense that when we have sensual desire, we're definitely getting something, we're definitely gaining something. There's no sense of letting go. There's no sense of renunciation, we call it. And then, anybody got any comments or about that? No? That sounds like a good point, actually. Good. Ill will and with also cruelty. Yes, until we do, until we see the disadvantages and the dangers in them, it's very difficult to give up. But it's very hard to develop that, actually. And I'm sure many people at AA, that's probably the difficult thing, to get to seeing the danger and the disadvantages in this addiction that they have, whatever it be. So, when the Buddha considered this, he said, this is quite important too. This leads to my own affliction. It subsided in me. So in other words, when he actually pondered that, this is very important for all of us actually, because the unwholesome and the wholesome, if we don't see the unwholesome as unwholesome, if we don't see the wholesome as wholesome, then we won't really be able to develop the wholesome and let go of the unwholesome. Because the issue is that we see that it is harming us. And this is very important because, as I say, with sensual desire, it seems to offer the mirage of happiness and well-being and everything we need. So to actually see that this is not wholesome is a very important part of the path. The essence of the path, actually, to me, seeing the wholesome and seeing the unwholesome. Yes. That's quite true, actually. And that's a very good point, because it points to the fact that, and I didn't mention this, to develop Sama Sankhapa, right intention, right attitude, you do need right view, some degree of right view. And for all of us, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path, until one's entered the Aryan Noble Eightfold Path to the stages of enlightenment, it will be a bit of developing wisdom, developing our attitude, intention, developing right speech, right action, right livelihood, developing our meditation, developing sati. But it'll be bits of each. But very importantly, if we, for instance, don't have the right view that there are causes and results from actions of body, speech and mind, and that we will experience the vipaka, the results of those actions, then we can quite easily get caught up in sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty, thinking, well, it's not hurting anybody, you know. But when we have an idea of karma or kamma, then that gives us it points our intention or our attitude in a particular direction. And the stronger our understanding of karma becomes, then the more that conditions our right intention, or Sama Sankhapa. And there's another aspect to that too, because of course you know that right view, Samaditti, is having an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And so that is very important for developing our intentions too. And the heart of that, of course, especially in terms of sensual desire, is seeing the villain of the piece, the problem of existence, is this craving, this desire, for whether it be for sensual desire or desire for existence or non-existence. This is the villain of the piece. So that is another aspect of right view that's very important. The third aspect I hardly ever hear anybody say about right view is that, and the Buddha mentions it quite often, that you have the view that there are Brahmins and ascetics that know this world and the other world, that have attained states, as it were, of wisdom and understanding, like the Buddha, you know, that the Buddha has actually attained enlightenment. Because when we have that understanding, that right view, then we can trust that the teachings that he has given us, the Noble Eightfold Path, these are coming from an enlightened being, someone that really knows and sees. So this is a very important part of right view. And as I say, we develop that right view gradually. And when we develop that, it conditions our right attitude to a large extent. Because once we know cause and effect is running, then we're very careful about what we do, what we say, and what we think, actually, as well. And that makes all the difference in terms of the karma that we're creating and the results that we'll experience. So, thank you. That's very good about wisdom, yes. So the Buddha, it subsided in him, this thought of sensual desire. And then he said, when I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. So it's talking about a process, isn't it? But he's using different levels of seeing the harm, the damage that sensual desire does. And then he says, I considered this leads to the affliction of both, and then it subsided in me. It's interesting. This, I don't know whether, for me, when I read this, it reminds me very much of the advice to Rahula, his son, where he said, you know, that you look at, very much the same, you look at the harm that your speech, your actions and your thoughts create for yourself, for others, for both. But he also said, interestingly, he said there, he doesn't say it here, he said to his son, the second criteria is, where am I coming from, the motivation? Is it a defilement I'm coming from? And then the third thing that he said to his son, maybe because he was spelling it out, what are the consequences of this action of body or speech or mind? So the Buddha is actually pointing at the same teaching, actually, that he slightly presented it slightly differently to his son Rahula in the advice to Rahula. So. In the advice to Rahula, he said to reflect on what one was going to say, what one was saying, doing, or thinking before one does it, during it, and afterwards. So this is actually like more than five times a day. It's you know, like an ongoing process, actually. But I imagine it's really comes into is particularly useful when there are strong negative emotions running. But it should emphasize, you know, we always talk about defilements, but we should also recognize our positive states, our wholesome states, and make much of those, because they often deal with the defilements. By encouraging those, the defilements don't have so much soil, so much a possibility for growth. I think, yeah, it requires enormous amount of mindfulness. And when you think, you know, the Buddha was giving this advice to his son when he was 7 years old, it is quite a lot to ask. But I think because of that, on that occasion, I gather the commentaries say that the reason for that advice to his son was because people were coming to the monastery, and Venerable Rahula would say, they'd ask him, oh, is the Buddha here? And he's like, no, he's not here. And the Buddha was there. He was just having fun. And then sometimes when the Buddha wasn't there, we'd say, oh, yeah, he's here. And so, like a little boy who's playing around, I think the Buddha was just trying to slow him down a bit, pointing him in the right direction to reflect on, you know, what he was doing and saying, and made very important special emphasis on lying, you know, because of that situation. But to me, that's like quite a delightful sort of scenario when you hear the context, the broader context. So, and then he considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulty, and leads away from nirvana, as I say, you know, more like the hindrances, causing difficulties, particularly like tanha, craving, and leads away from nirvana because it's not peaceful and because it's outside. It's always external, sensual desire. When a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So this is the way he did. So it's like a process of, first of all, mindfulness and then reflection. But it's reflection at a deep level, because for us to actually see that something is harmful for ourselves is difficult. To actually see that it obstructs wisdom is difficult too, causes problems, and doesn't lead towards nibbana. It's interesting. How would, good question, the Bodhisattva know what was leading to nibbana? He hadn't experienced Nibbana yet. So it's an interesting thing. But I think there's a general consensus of opinion, wasn't there, with the spiritual practitioners of the time. Nibbana was obviously renunciation, you know, and they lived the renunciant life. They were wandering ascetics and that sort of thing. So, but it's interesting. How did he know? I mean, he knew afterwards, but at the time. So, any comments? Any other comments? Or good. And then we go on to, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. And then the abbreviation is, a thought of cruelty arose in me. So both those states. I understood thus, this thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. Another important thing that comes to me when I read that, and I did actually when I first read it, was the fact that, yes, the bodhisattva is like us. The bodhisattva had defilements. You know, you tend to have a very idealized view of the Buddha, you know, and of course when he attained Buddhahood, all the defilements gone. But it is very good for us to know that he had these difficulties. He had these defilements. Why is that? Because it's an encouragement for us to know, yes, it's possible to get rid of these defilements. That the Buddha, in his last life, wasn't, you know, he had these defilements to deal with as well, like we do. So it makes it much more makes it a path that we too can travel, not just special beings like the Bodhisattva. And that is quite important, especially when there's quite a heavy emphasis on the teaching of paramis. So when you have an emphasis on paramis, you know, the development of spiritual perfections over eons and eons, it tends to make it a bit remote for us because we haven't been developing our paramis over eons and eons. But it's obvious that the Buddha in Buddha to be in his last life, he had these defilements too. So that's, I think, something. I notice when people give talks, actually, it's quite interesting, when they give talks, people really relate to the fact of hardships, the difficulties that a person's had in their spiritual practice, rather than, you know, just all the positives, rather than the goal, you know, having arrived at the destination. Because we're all travelling that path with difficulties and problems. So the humanity of the Buddha is a very important part of the teachings. Because later teachings, of course, they made him into some, I think it's Lakutra Vada tradition, later Buddhist school, they made him sort of above the world, you know, so that he's not of the world, more like a god, more like a special being. And it's very important for us to know that the Buddha was a human being, you know, just like us. A very intelligent human being, I think, if he came up, by pondering, he came upon this teaching, this understanding is quite something. So, we continue. Anybody have any comments to that? No? He says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu, this is very important, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, and then upon thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thoughts of he's abandoned the thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty to cultivate the thoughts of ill will and cruelty. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of ill will and cruelty. And I think this is quite an important, for me, a very important part of the sutta, actually, that points out whatever we give attention to, that grows. If we give attention to the unwholesome, that grows. And I know in our society, I see this quite a lot, and even see it in some of my friends, often cultivating some of these negative qualities, aren't we? Sort of, you know, like in this world, anger is often encouraged, you know, in the sense of self-assertion, you know, you've got to, you know, put up a fight and all that sort of thing. Don't let them walk over you, that sort of attitude. So we often see that we're cultivating negative things, but as I said before, if we don't realize what we're cultivating, it's very easy to be going in the wrong path. If we don't recognize sensual desire as sensual desire, ill will as ill will, and cruelty as cruelty, then we can cultivate them in ignorance, thinking, maybe I have to do this, you know, for my own self-preservation, for my own good. If I'm not going to look after number one, who will? So. And it's also very important from another aspect that if we put focus, if we put attention, here it's the negative side, but if we put attention on the positive side, what that will grow, that will overshadow the weeds and the negative plants in the garden, in nature, because that's going to take up the nutrients, that's going to take up the focus of the mind, that's going to become bigger. And that is actually a very important part of the path, not always fighting the defilements head on in confrontation. The other way, more happy way actually, develop the wholesome qualities, the positive qualities we all have, and make them grow so that then they displace, they don't give room to the negative qualities. So that's quite useful. Anybody like to comment about that? That's and then the Buddha gives a lovely simile here. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. That's quite a nice, quite a good simile for it. What do people think that the way Buddha talks about, he was constantly, the cowherd constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Any ideas? What would that be referring to, that simile? Yep. Definitely mindfulness, and probably, you know, Hiriyotaba too, wouldn't it be that, you know, that sense of shame and fear of the consequences of one's actions of body, speech and mind. Because, yes, definitely, this is number one, isn't it? If we don't have sati, if we don't have mindfulness, we have no idea of what we're doing, what's going on, and there's no way, of course, we can see things truly as they are, because we don't know what's happening. We're not with it. So that's very important, yes. The Buddha is, the Bodhisattva is using mindfulness to tap and poke the cows so they don't stray into the crops and destroy the crops. It's also interesting that there's that sense too, isn't there, that where he says it could be flogged, imprisoned, fined or blamed. So it's a sense of a standard, isn't it, really? You know, often you hear in the suttas, you know, that something that is praised by the wise or blamed by the wise. And I think the Buddha has this in mind, or Bodhisattva had in mind, that there are some things that, you know, that the wise tell us these are not things to be developed, not to be encouraged. It's interesting because I was visiting a friend yesterday, a friend who's 99, not out, and she was actually telling us, Rodney and I, about her childhood, and it was similar to this in a way, that her parents just did not encourage anger. She said she never saw her parents, particularly her father, ever act in anger. That must be in speech or in action. And she said in their family it was just considered not acceptable to be angry. But she said the youngest sister, she said she was given to being an angry person. It took a long time for her parents to, as it were, bring it home to her, the disadvantages of it. And they never used any physical punishment. This is quite interesting. And she said they always had this, the only punishment was, well, maybe you go to your room and when you're feeling right in yourself, then you come out. But this was not encouraging this anger to be developed. And in the same way, you know, if we have a standard, we know what's not acceptable. We don't have it in the boundaries of the acceptable. And I think this is what the Bodhisattva is pointing to as well. Though, of course, we have to have wisdom and understanding to go with it as well, you know, to see that it's not for our benefit. It's not just what we're being told to do. We can see that it has got a basis in experience. Right, so. It's all the danger, and it's also in wholesome states, the blessing of renunciation, and this aspect of cleansing. Of course, the blessing of renunciation is this simplicity that brings to life, that we can let go. When we let go, no problem. The only thing is, we can only let go from wisdom. We can't let go from willpower. So it's only with understanding that we can actually let go. Often people try and push renunciation. You know, start giving up this, giving up that. But really, if it doesn't come from an understanding of why they're doing it, what's the point? Then that sort of renunciation is not going in the right, not coming from the right place, as it were. It has to come from wisdom. It has to come from a growing, deepening understanding of the path and seeing that these things that I once thought absolutely essential, not essential. In fact, they cause me extra work, they cause difficulties, as the Bodhisattva was describing. So, and it has the aspect of cleansing. This is very important too. I find it a very strong simile in, for me, when I think of defilements, you know, cleaning the mind is actually quite a strong image for me that I like very much. You know, clearing the path of the leaves. It's like clearing the defilements, cleansing the mind, washing it, cleaning it. Very important. And it's actually quite a useful way to reflect on dealing with our negativities. You know, because there's a delight, isn't there? When you see something clean that was really grubby before, and you really think, the mind feels really bright, it's quite good. So. Yes, that's good. Danger, degradation and defilement. I think degradation usually means that it's, it like brings you down. That's how I understand degradation, that it degrades you. That's, you know, sort of really reduces you to, a level that, you're not happy with really. You know, it might be a very basic, sort of more like an animal level perhaps, responding, getting what I want, you know. And so it sort of degrades. What it degrades, of course, is the mind, you know, the quality of the mind, which can have like peace, stillness, happiness, bliss in it. But when it's got this strong desire for things, strong ill will or cruelty, it really feels like the mind's been brought down, and it's really at a level of, you know, a very grubby level actually, you know, sort of very, yeah. With depression. I think that would be an aspect of it. Yeah, it would be an aspect of it. Because, you know, like depression, you know, anger and aversion can go in two ways, can't it? It can go out, and we see a lot of that expressed, and then people get into anger and do all manner of things and receive the results of that, of course. But it can go inside too, anger, and it becomes out when it's not expressed and there's no wisdom. It can take this repressed form often people talk about, you know, and it can become this sort of depression, this like low self-esteem, you know. And it can give rise to outbursts of violence because it's sort of repressed without understanding. But of course the Buddha, when you're talking about using mindfulness, there is understanding there. We know what's going on. We know there's an essential desire there. We know that there's anger. We know that there's ill will and cruelty there. And if you know something is there and you choose not to act on it, that's quite a different thing from repressing it. You've got a choice. You're acknowledging that the thing exists. When people usually repress, they don't even acknowledge it. They may not even realize I'm angry or I've got a lot of sensual desire. So yes, could be part of depression. Ah, right. And then the Buddha continues with the opposite. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to the other, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a day, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and concentrated it. Why is that? So that the mind should not be strained. So this is putting the opposite case, talking about thoughts of renunciation. And I think it's really important. This word renunciation too, I think many people, myself included, I find it a difficult word. I don't really, respond to it as an English word. But letting go and letting be, I think this side of renunciation, often we call it abandoning, don't we, too? That's the other side, abandoning it. But as I said, renunciation comes from wisdom, has to come from wisdom. Otherwise, if it's coming from willpower, it's not coming from wisdom, and it will not have the effect one wants. You can see this sometimes, can't you? You can see what I would call ostentatious asceticism. And in India, you can see that even today, sadhus, they may not all be, doing it from a negative point of view, but, like standing on your leg, one leg for many, many years, or having one arm up for many, many years, and such practices, that really people can see. And so it's a very obvious one. And that seems like, that's in many people's book, that's renunciation, isn't it? But it sort of, it depends on the motivation that it's done with. And of course the Buddha said that sort of austerity is not to be encouraged. That is taking it, taking one of the extremes, atakilamata, new yoga. So one can, as it were, be doing ostentatious renunciation. The real renunciation is from inside, from wisdom, not from people seeing you. You see it in Sri Lanka a bit too, actually. Sometimes people are very impressed when they see monks don't wear shoes and don't use umbrellas, and that sort of thing. And just very external sorts of things, really. And they can be very impressed by that. And really, we don't know where that's coming from, Sometimes you can see a lot of pride coming with it, spiritual pride, aren't I good? I'm practicing this austerity or that austerity. And of course, if one's practicing with that state of mind, one's encouraging defilement and going in the opposite direction to nibbana. But it can happen. And it's sort of the opposite that the Buddha is, the Bodhisattva is contemplating the, as it were, the value of renunciation, seeing that it's no harm, and it's not an obstacle to wisdom, and it doesn't cause difficulties. It leads to nibbana, and then he could contemplate like this for a night, a day, and a night, a day, a night, a day, and a night, without any ill consequences, except that the excessive thinking would tire the body. That's interesting, isn't it? Tire the body. I would have thought, tire the mind. But it's interesting because I know Ajahn Brahm was talking the other day, I've heard this before, that the mind actually takes a lot of the bodily energy to run it. So I suppose if you're contemplating a lot of the energy is going to the mind, so the body's actually got less energy. So perhaps that's what it's talking about. I think they say something like 60% of the energy goes for the operating the brain, keeping the brain going, the mind. And it's important, he says too, that it leads to the mind being strained. One would imagine sort of a bit distracted, as it were, and far from concentration because there's much thinking going on. So he steadied his mind, internally quieted it and brought it to singleness and concentrated it. And why would you think, obviously a very fruitful line of thinking, why would the Bodhisattva turn to developing singleness of mind at this stage? Why not continue investigating? Leads to, yes, restlessness? Yes, yeah. And it doesn't go deep enough, because you might notice, I've noticed, with thinking, you can often get to a level of thinking, and it just goes around and around on that level, but it doesn't go deeper. And so the importance of quietening the mind, bringing it to singleness, is that then the mind can penetrate, go much deeper than this level of thought. And the aim, of course, for all of us, is direct experience. Not thinking about it, not thinking about the Noble Eightfold Path, not thinking about meditation, not thinking about Nibbana. It's actually experiencing it. And that I think is what the Bodhisattva was pointing to. Thinking about it all very well, but knowing it for experience, this is the aim, this is the purpose. So this is what samadhi is for, this singleness of mind, ekagata. Good. And he continues, the Bodhisattva continues, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose in me. And then, the abbreviation, a thought of non-cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-ill will, non-cruelty, has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nirvana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained, so be at peace and can penetrate deeply. One of the comments I'd make about this, and when you hear this non-ill will and non-cruelty, it sounds a bit of a mouthful. And you wonder exactly what it's pointing to. I think, and it's the same with the precepts, isn't it? When we say panatipata viram and isikapadang samadhiyami, I undertake the training rule to refrain from killing living beings. And this one, non-ill will and non-cruelty. But often we say non-ill will is like metta. And non-cruelty is karuna, compassion, like you were mentioning just a moment ago. But I think there's also a level, it's the same in the precepts, where if we just refrain from something, if we're not generating ill will, if we're not generating cruelty, if we're not killing living beings, this is a level of good karma immediately. It's the minimum level for developing the wholesome. Because if you're not doing those unwholesome things of body or mind or speech, then we're not generating negative karma. Then we're opening the path to liberation. But this is a minimum level. And, people say, it's all a bit negative, especially the five precepts. And you say, refrain from this, refrain from that. And then we talk about the positive aspects of developing, for instance, metta, compassion for beings, instead of killing beings, compassion and so on. And this is the positive aspect of the precepts. But first of all, the basic level is this refraining from. And this is important. It's not just metta. We may not have a lot of metta, but we may refrain from killing living beings. We may refrain from developing aversion. We mightn't have a lot of metta, We're not getting angry and irritable with people. We're just, maybe we're just mindful in the present moment. And we're not getting, developing cruelty. We're in a state of non-cruelty, not harming. So I'm trying to make the distinction between like a minimum level and a level of development. As I say, with the precepts, we can develop not killing to compassion, not stealing to generosity, not committing sexual misconduct to like reliability, dependability, contentment, not lying to truthfulness, not taking drugs, alcohol and drugs that are a basis for negligence, for heedlessness, they say. Then can take that to the positive level, developing extreme mindfulness, exactly knowing exactly what's going on. So that this is two levels. And so when we talk about non-ill will and non-cruelty, this can be the basic level. But we can take that to metta, and metta, of course, can be developed as almost a path leading to liberation. And compassion, too, can lead us towards liberation as well. So there's this minimum level, and there's a level that we can develop it to. And when the Buddha became the Bodhisattva, when the Bodhisattva became the Buddha, of course, he developed both of those qualities to the max. So metta and karuna, and mudita, and also upekkha, so joy with others, and equanimity as well. So, any comments about non-ill will and non-cruelty? Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's very true, you know, to refrain, yes. And yes. Shouldn't take, yeah, yeah. That's correct, yes. The precepts are refraining, not that I shall not, yes, like a commandment. I think the important thing, I like actually the translation, instead of precept, is training rule, because it emphasizes this is a training. I'm not perfect. I'm going towards that. That's my aspiration, you know, not to kill living beings, not to take alcohol and so on. I saw a very interesting translation of the fifth one. It's something like, I undertake to refrain from the abusive use of alcohol and intoxicants, like abusing them. I thought, wow, that's quite a sort of open interpretation, you know, what would one call abuse, you know. I'm not abusing it if I have half a bottle, but I'm abusing it if I have a bottle and a half. I'm not sure. It was really unusual, because the idea of abuse really opens up a whole area, you know, that may even be, you know, well, you know, I'm not abusing it. Yes, I am tipsy and a bit drunk, but I'm not abusing it. And that's the trouble with alcohol and drugs, you know, they blur the mindfulness. So you talk to people who are really intoxicated, and you can tell it, and they say, well, nothing wrong with me. And I think they really mean it, you know. Heard the story of last night talking to a friend, and she works in school, and a parent turned up to pick up the children, and he was a bit under the weather, and the teacher said, you know, no way you're going to drive. I will drive the kids and yourself to your home, because you're under the weather. And he kept saying to her, no, I'm okay, I'm all right, there's no problem. I'm always, you know, I do this quite often. So this is the danger, you know. I always remember Ajahn Jagaro would always say, you know, people say, well, a little bit's okay. But how to determine what's a little bit is interesting. You need a lot of wisdom, which you don't have when you're having the drink. So, bit of a catch-22. So, now I'm going to continue. So the Buddha continues with... yes, that's right. The simile... Oh, wait a minute. Thoughts of non-cruelty, good. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the village, a cowherd would guard his cows whilst staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, Since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there, so too there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. So this is obviously, just in this situation, because they're wholesome states, I missed out a bit, didn't I? That bit. Yeah, I did miss out that. I'll read that bit. So we'll read that number 11. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, or upon thoughts of non-cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of ill will to cultivate the thought of non-ill will, and he has abandoned the thought of cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty. And then the simile about the cowherd. So again, where we put our emphasis, where we put our attention, that's what grows. And if we can put it on the positives of like renunciation, letting go, particularly of sensual desire, and which brings us a lot of difficulties in our life often, and if we can let go of, non-ill will and non-cruelty, even if at the minimum level, not necessarily the more developed level of metta and karuna, of loving kindness and compassion, if we can put the emphasis there, we give no room for the negative qualities of sensual desire, of ill will and cruelty to overshadow the mind. So the Bodhisattva, with these positive qualities in mind, didn't need that sort of degree of mindfulness that was poking and prodding the cows, because these are wholesome states of mind, can be aware of the thoughts of renunciation, the thoughts of non-ill will and non-cruelty, is cultivating. And I think it's a good thing for all of us to think, what are we cultivating? Are we really cultivating the positives in our lives? That's quite a good thing to reflect on. So, and then the Bodhisattva begins what you probably recognize as the preliminary to the enlightenment experience of the Buddha. And I'll only read the abbreviated one, but if you want to read the full one, it's got the reference here in another sutta. So, he continues, tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified, and then quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana. And then he entered and abided upon in the second jhana, the third jhana, and the fourth jhana. And having, it's good to actually have a little praise here, I think. And then having come out of the fourth jhana, when his mind was concentrated, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, that means like unshakableness, I directed it to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. And then the Bodhisattva recollected his past lives. And he said, this was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. And then, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. So past lives, the first part of the night, first watch of the night, and then karma in the second watch of the night, seeing beings passing away according to their action, and being reborn according to their actions in their past lives. And the Bodhisattva continues, still the Bodhisattva. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent and resolute. And then, when my mind, it continues from the third watch of the night, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew, by experience, as it actually is, this is suffering. I directly knew, as it actually is, this is the origin of suffering. I directly knew, as it is, as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. I directly knew, as it actually is, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is on page 106, sorry, if you're looking for it. And then the Bodhisattva Buddha actually continued, I directly knew it as it actually is. These are the taints. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the origin of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the cessation of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. These are the asavas, the outflowings, usually of sensual desire, the taint of being, wanting to continue existence, and the last one, usually they say ignorance, avijja. And then, the most important statement, when I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge. It is liberated, the mind is liberated. I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So that is the enlightenment experience where the Bodhisattva became the Buddha. And part of that experience, obviously, you hear many different expositions of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. Some of them will, for instance, emphasize paticca-samuppada, dependent origination. But here the Buddha is talking about the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path being a pivotal understanding that helped, led to the enlightenment. And then to finish off, this is a lovely simile that comes at the end actually, where the Buddha says, suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path to be travelled joyfully, interesting, joyfully. And he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster and loss. But another man came desiring their good, welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness. And he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase and fulfillment. Bhikkhus, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path. That is wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good, welfare and protection is a term for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path to be travelled joyfully is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path, That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, because the safe and good path to be travelled joyfully has been reopened by me, the wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy destroyed. So this is a lovely simile, isn't it, for us? Very, very clear, actually. And I think when the Buddha talks about, interestingly enough, about the false path, the wrong Noble Eightfold Path, this is must be a path with defilements operating, where also maybe the distortions or vipalasas are operating, where we see the impermanent as permanent, when we see suffering as happiness, when we see beauty, when we see what is not beautiful as beautiful, and when we see what is non-self as self, when those are operating as well as the defilements. And of course, the villain of the piece behind it, the sense of I. This is making it all possible. And the Buddha is pointing towards that too with this simile. But one of the very important things I found with this, stood out for me anyway, I think for everyone something else may stand out. The safe and good path to be travelled joyfully. I think this is very interesting because, you know, often people can make heavy weather of their spiritual life. And I think the Buddha is reminding us it's to be travelled joyfully. And of course, you know, when you're talking about sammasankappa, right intention, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-cruelty, this is pointing us in a direction of being joyful, of having a positive approach, an approach to the path, to our lives, to our practice, to meditation, which is not coming from any, not coming from the defilements, not coming from the greed, not coming from aversion, and not coming from ignorance or confusion, or delusion, we usually call it. So, and this is good news for us too, that the path is open, and the Tathagata, the Buddha, has made clear what is the decoy, because, you know, of course, this is a very good image for sensual desire, isn't it? Promises a lot, but it's really it's like a decoy. I often think of it as like, you know, the lure they use for fishing, you know, when they catch fish, particularly freshwater fish, they use sort of some attractive lure that looks like an insect that the fish grabs the hook and then it's caught. And this is like the decoy in a way, you know, it catches us, it has an appealing appearance, and all too often we swallow it and reap the consequences of that desire. So that's the... And then, very nicely, the Buddha... Anybody have any comments about that before we conclude the sutta? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, it wouldn't hit them, that's good. Hmm. Mm. Mm. Yes, they didn't have so much then, I think. Yeah, exactly. No. Well, I think too, you know, this you're just mentioning the idea of, you know, when children are naughty or misbehaving, and then most people think you have to give them a good smack and so on. But when I was talking to this friend Wynne yesterday, I realized, you know, if you are trying to discourage, make unacceptable anger and the consequences, which is like action and speech, if you hit them, the message is that I'm going to use anger, as it were, to try and get rid of anger. The message is inconsistent with what you're aiming at. It's like the old oxymoron of fighting for peace. If we want peace, we shouldn't be fighting like that. Not in a negative sense, anyway. So, yes, no, I agree. You know, most people would think a good smack necessary, yes. But, yes. That's right, yeah. Yes, you can. Yeah, that's right. You can, to avoid the being smacked, one can sort of lie or not be truthful, yes. So, that's almost just after 4:15, so maybe we can finish with the last statements, which are, as the Buddha often said, and it's a good reminder for us actually, what should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, very good. So just conclude by saying this is really like, as I say, an exposition of Sammasankappa, right intention, and very important for us all that we do have that, as Ajahn Brahm calls it, you know, that quality of letting be, letting go in our lives, that we do have gentleness with ourselves and others, and also that we have this kindness for ourselves and others too, so that we aren't always trying to get, and we're not always coming from ill will or aversion, negative mind state, or being cruel to others or to ourselves. Good. So, with that, maybe we can finish off. We can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And if anyone has any other questions, you're welcome to come up.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ namāmi vākato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supakipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami.
So thank you for coming on a very hot day, and I hope it's been of use for your spiritual practice and understanding of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I thank you for your comments too, and they're very, very interesting and useful. Because I think discussion is very useful, actually, for our understanding. Good. Yeah. Thank you.